From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
This is Cade Massey, practice professor at the Wharton School. This month around here, we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of Wharton Moneyball. We have been doing the show almost every week for 10 years now, and we thought we might sit down on that occasion and reflect a bit on those 10 years. A couple of weeks ago, the whole crew sat down here in Wharton Studios and talked a bit about how the world of sports analytics has changed in those 10 years, what we've learned in those 10 years, and some of our favorite moments from the shows we've done together over the years. We had fun reflecting and thinking about that time, and we share with you, as this week's show, a lightly edited version of that conversation. Hope you enjoy. This is Cade Massey, practice professor here at the Wharton School, sitting with three of my closest faculty colleagues and longtime Wharton Moneyball collaborators. Wharton Moneyball is a show that's been on SiriusXM's Business Radio since its beginning 10 years ago. And we decided, coming up on the 10-year anniversary, we're about a week away, we thought we'd pause, take a moment, and think back on those 10 years, especially because the world's kind of changed in those 10 years. What do we think we've learned from it? I'm sitting with Audie Weiner, professor of statistics, Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics, and Shane Jensen, professor of statistics as well. A bunch of stats guys. And we've been doing sports analytics.
We're also data science now. We've been added that since we began the show.
Oh, there's a change in the last 10 years. Statisticians have become data scientists, or at least some of them have. Why don't we start there? Why don't we start with the question of how you feel the world of sports analytics has changed in the 10 years? Our first show was March 2014. We've seen a few changes.
I mean, Audie kind of alluded to it a little bit here. I think just sort of the public consciousness of kind of data has really changed a lot. You know, I no longer have to go and explain to people, like, why I'm a statistician,
right,
or why I do, why
right?
I work with data. I think so. I think that really has changed. On the other side, I think sports has also become cooler within the sort of statistical academic community in the time in the last 10 years as well. I was kind of looking back. I started as a faculty in 04, and 05 was the first issue of the Journal of Quantitative Analysis of Sports. When I was first coming up through graduate school, I was interested in sports, but I was cautioned a lot, like, do not, you know, do sports as an academic topic, you know, maybe have it as a side hobby, but don't make it your main thing. And now we've got flagship journals in sports analytics. And I think in the 10 years we've been doing this show, I think, you know, sports has gone from kind of being this sort of black sheep to this something where this is where you see a lot of the coolest kind of spatial temporal data situations. So it's almost kind of on the cutting edge of methodology now.
It certainly is accepted. I remember when you arrived, that's when I just got tenured that time. And that was the first time I decided to work on sports. I waited until I had job security before I could work in sports. I wouldn't give that advice anymore. I'd say jump right in.
The field is always going to chase the coolest data. And that's really, I think, the difference that's happened. I think the reality is sports has data that rivals really any other industry today. And I think that's why academia is moving in that direction. I think that's why student interest is there. I think also it's a great testing ground for learning statistical methods.
You know, one particular kind of data that's blown up almost exactly in the window we've been doing this show is spatiotemporal. So the kind of the dawn of that in my mind was when Kirk Goldsberry got the data at Harvard from the NBA. And he ran across Luke Bourne, and I believe that was 2012. That was just preceding our show. So we've been there kind of from the beginning, and we saw this thing blow up, and now it's secondhand.
I think maybe, Kate, to answer your question for me, the part that's gotten most interesting to me is the problems. Meaning, if you think about the original Moneyball, right, it was mainly about on-field stuff. But now if you think about the role of analytics, I'm even thinking about just the papers the people here have written, it's not just the on-field part. It's about the business of sports. It's about, you know, trying to make decisions on sleep and training patterns, et cetera, which is, to me, the narrow set of problems, which was, let's attack, should we go for it on fourth and one? You know, are walks as valuable as singles? I'm not saying those aren't important problems, but the problems have grown so diverse. And that's the part that's exciting to me, and I think that's what's really changed.
I have to say, just, I can give you a number. It wouldn't be a statistics show without a number. When I first taught Moneyball Academy, which was our high school sports analytics program over the summer, the first summer we barely had more applicants than we had space. We had 55 applications for 50 spots. This past year, we have two rounds, and we have already 350. I don't think we're going to do a second round. That's just show how incredibly the interest in sports analytics, mm-hmm. even at the young level, has just exploded.
One element that you alluded to, Eric, that I think is worth underscoring is that you're so right. In the beginning, we were talking about more or less in-game decision-making and personnel. I think the principal third that has evolved really only in the last 7 or 8 years is performance enhancement, performance yep. change. And the classic examples of the Astros bringing in these pitchers and teaching them to throw a different way. And that's a use of technology and analytics that just wasn't happening at all. And it's entirely different from the other two. Okay, that question was about how the field has changed. This next one's more or less how y'all have changed. So what have you learned?
I've learned a lot by listening to all of you. And the thing that kept coming into my mind, since I knew you'd ask the question, was base rates, which is for me to move away from a base rate. You better have a good reason. And also, I was probably one of those people that thought effect sizes was much bigger than I now think it's much smaller. Like, I used to think, well, it's a 90-10 game. You know, Clayton Kershaw and the Dodgers are playing, I don't know, the lowly Pirates. 90% for the Dodgers. No. You'd never predict.
You think you're different now than if you were sitting here 10 years ago.
I do. I think I'm different because
You were a chaired professor of marketing statistics, 47 yes. years old 10 years ago. And you
Why
were
do you
like,
keep bringing up the age? Right? You were 47 10 years ago, too.
As was
Audie.
Right.
We're all born in 1967.
I was only 37.
Yeah,
that's
true. I'm not being critical at all. I'm yeah. honestly querying. That's phenomenal that's been a consequence of these 10 years.
And I also mm-hmm. think I adjusted too much. Like, well, it's a left-handed pitcher against this team.
With momentum.
Yeah, well, momentum we'll get to. I still believe in momentum. Okay. That part hasn't changed. But I believe in base rates, and I don't move off them as far as I think I used to.
So when we started this show, I knew a lot about baseball. But I was really terrified how we were going to fill 2 hours talking about sports, that it can't be all about baseball, because what am I going to say? And I've certainly learned a lot about sports. I think everyone is proud of my accomplishments in the football arena in mm-hmm. particular, but all sports especially. But the way you're able to do it is basically bring those base rate facts and questions to any sport. Mm. So I might not know anything about golf, but I can contribute by asking, mm-hmm. what's the mean? What's the standard deviation? What's a typical player do in these situations? Mm-hmm. And sometimes what I found is my lack of knowledge about a sport works very well with the experts, because it brings you back to earth.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this, too. And actually, it's a little related to what Eric was talking about a little bit, too. I kind of feel like when this show first started, I mean, you know, I was trained as a statistician. I feel like I'm decent at probabilistic kind of thinking and thinking in the presence of probability. But I have learned repeatedly over this decade how easy it is for, like, biases and probabilistic thinking to creep in. I think of the inevitability kind of bias that I have. You bring it up, like, every college football season, right, where we kind of, like, halfway through the season, we're locked into a national championship game.
No, not that. When he asks at the beginning of the season, what probability do you think is assigned to these yeah. four teams?
Yeah.
And I'll say, like, 15% of cases, like, it's, like, less than 1%. Like, total overestimation.
And I think I've learned from myself that in situations, especially, like, you know, I think now of, like, you know, the Kansas City Chiefs and the current dynasty, in situations where there's kind of, you know, a dominant team or something like that, my own mind, I tend to, like, when you've got, like, something like a probability of 0.75 or 0.8, you round it up to 1. And so kind of thinking about those sort of like, you know, like even intermediary probability events, like a 20%, you know, a real mismatch in sports would be like an 80 to 20 thing. Thinking, you know, not thinking about that as an inevitable victory, like, you know, thinking about that 20% and kind of processing it, you know, every time you see it. I think that's a lesson I've kind of learned.
I'll give you a couple of quick ones. One, I'm struck by how many times we figure things out collectively. And it's connected to my other one, which is everyone's wrong sometimes. And I've learned that in other environments. One of the nice things about working on faculty is that you see some really smart people be wrong. It's helpful to see that. We're all wrong sometimes. You guys are some of the sharpest guys I have conversations with, and you're all wrong sometimes.
Well, let's just take what the facts are. I'm wrong more than all of you. Because you remember, we've actually...
Yeah,
no. For years, yeah. remember, we've picked outcomes of games and yeah. kept scores. I think I have momentum that I'm the lowest every single year we've done. Matter of fact, I don't think we've done this in a few years. Matter of fact, I think it's because you guys want to keep me at the bottom.
That's right.
We need to go back because I'm last
fun.
Place every year. I just tell people I'm in fourth place and like, that sounds impressive. I don't tell them there's only four of us making these predictions.
Well, the last thing that I feel like I've learned is the power of doing something, a little bit of something on a regular basis. I think the cumulative effect of doing this show, even though it's only been 2 hours a week and now just 1 hour a week, but we've done it 50 weeks a year for 10 years. The cumulative effect in terms of what I know, my relationship with y'all, the people we know in industry, is amazing. All right, what about themes that have emerged on our show? We kind of come back to some of the same bits. You guys have just talked about base rates, for example. That's definitely been a theme. What else would you say are some patterns or some themes?
Well, come on. It has to be what Adi mentioned. I mean, you guys, I don't know, ridicule is a fine word, but in a professional, nice way. You guys ridicule me about momentum. I still believe momentum exists, but I'm willing to say that there's at least heavy non-stationarity. I'm from the old school Bayesian world, which means I believe in cross-unit, cross-person heterogeneity. What I think I'm going to spend the next 20 years of my career on is within-person heterogeneity, which is, if you think about something we talk about, like a hidden Markov model, like people go through hot and cold states. Well, that's about a given unit. That's not a cross-unit statement. I think we, in the show, have spent a lot of time talking about whether you want to call it momentum, non-stationarity, et cetera. And I think it's a great thing because I think a lot of times we focus on differences across units and not as much sometimes there's peak periods and weak periods within a unit.
But if I were to answer like what theme that we've, I mean, is, and this is, I guess, so important in basic statistics, we think about regression and that just drives just about everything we do. And I don't mean it just in regression as the forecasting tool. So much of our dialogue is concentrate on how much to regress and how what data we use to figure out.
And what
are we regressing to? And so it's a really a great amalgam of some of the most important themes of statistics, regression, and we've become artists in describing these hard concepts in our sports, and I think it's made me a much better teacher.
I've also kind of developed sort of like a little bit more of, I think, a protection against the sort of some of the recency biases. Right. Like when you see some unusual performance or some new thing hit a sport, you know, are you just looking at kind of the random variation of a particular pitcher like suddenly having a standout performance? Is that an example of a non-stationary thing where we can see that, you know, we can predict that for that pitcher going forward? Or are we just kind of biased by the recency of a really standout performance? I think back one of our, back 2015, I think, when the Kansas City Royals won the World Series, we spent like weeks after that talking about how they've revolutionized baseball with the way they like got to the World Series with like, you know, shut down relief pitching and fielding and all these types of things. And, you know, I mean, they did do all that, but how much that actually, we should have really regressed even more those kind of trends towards, you know, the mean, because it wasn't maintained.
All right, guys. Can you go back 10 years? Can you remember the first show? We're in a basement here at the Wharton School. We were in a different basement when we started, before the studio existed. What were you thinking as we... Eric rounded us up. Let's give credit to Eric. I remember sitting in his office the first time. What were y'all thinking on day one?
I remember two things. First of all, I remember being nervous, speaking live. The very first show was a live radio broadcast. There's no opportunity to fix what we did. And I remember being concerned about that. So that was the first thing. The second thing was really bothered me. I'm curious to know what your thoughts. I didn't know how we were going to fill 2 hours. And that's, of course, been the most pleasant surprise. I feel like we can fill 2 hours. In fact, there was a crazy time where none of you were there and all the entire sound went out and there was no communications
alone. But it was live.
And it was live and I had to talk for a half an hour to no one about nothing for a half hour and it was no problem.
That might be a professorial skill that you've developed over time. It's possible.
Yeah, I was never worried about us filling up time at all. Not in the slightest, because in my case, I just watch so many different sports and so much sports, and I'm just used to also taking notes when I'm watching sports on things that also, to me, the beauty of sports for me is that it's the ultimate Trojan horse to talk about any statistical topic. So I was never, ever worried about it. And also, my view was, if I'm having fun, the audience is having fun.
No, and I remember that I can echo the nervousness of, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, again, we've learned since then also that you're your encyclopedic knowledge of sports. I can say stupid stuff every show and you're there to kind of, as you know, sort of a instant fact checker. So that was reassuring. And I also do think I kind of worried for a while that we would sort of be able to kind of generate 2 hour, you know, like mm-hmm. that amount of material every week. But as we started doing the show and we started seeing these kind of various themes popping up, I started seeing them everywhere. Like,
You start looking for them.
You start looking for them. And you do sort of like kind of, it enabled me to sort of see connections between sports at the kind of the base, you know, between versus within variation, these kind of basic levels that, you know, basically allowed me to kind of, I think, branch out to sports like tennis that I didn't have much experience with before the show even started.
Shane, you're talking about between sports makes me think about tournament design as a late answer to an emerging theme. I never knew I was so interested in tournament design until this show came along. What about favorite moments? We talked about how you were thinking about it 10 years ago. 10 years of shows. Any favorite moments come to mind?
Well, just because we were talking about the early days in Vance Hall, I think one of the first Super Bowl kind of, I think it was Super Bowl 49, the Malcolm Butler interception, was one of my favorite shows we came in. I mean, obviously, you know, my team won it all, right. But it was more coming in and just sort of like, it was early on in our history. It just seemed like just kind of the perfect time to talk about something that had, like, obviously a lot of consequence, but also like a lot of analytical strategy discussed. And just sort of seeing that kind of moment being discussed in the, like, 10 years to follow, and how that kind of discussion of that particular, like, play has been informed by 10 years of kind of, you know, increasingly sophisticated analysis.
I told Adi just before the show taping here what I was going to talk about. But part of it is just, I love seeing your reaction each time, Cade. I'm going to talk about Joey Chestnut.
I was going to bring it up.
Just, I mean, again, I want to say for our listeners here, I want to say it again. Hot dog eating is a real sport. You can train for it. And I'll tell you the thing I like about it as well is that you can measure atypicality. And that's the thing, is that you can measure how many more hot dogs can this person eat than that one. And when Joey Chestnut can eat 20, 25 more than other people, and people have now, especially now, he's been like the 15-time mustard belt champion. Why haven't people caught up to him? I'm just saying, part of it is just seeing your reaction. I just love it because I, in my heart, I'm not just saying it to piss you off. I really think it's a sport, and I love talking. And when he came on the air and he talked about his training methods and everything else, I'm like, this is a real scientist working here.
20 years from our 20th anniversary, Cade will have totally turned around on this, I think.
No, he won't.
You're not there yet, I can tell already.
So any other favorite moments, Adi?
So I have a bunch of favorite moments. So it's interesting because not really concentrating on the guest per se, because we've had some recurrent guests who are incredible. But the moments for me are when I learn something that's shockingly new to me. So I remember when Rick Peterson told something to us.
Remind us.
Rick Peterson was a pitching coach, a longtime pitching coach. He was the Oakland A's, and he was on our show quite frequently in the beginning.
As a regular guest.
And as a baseball analyst, one of the big strategic questions is why you're not bringing in your relievers at the high leverage moments. And we analysts were always saying, well, this is just dumb. How come they have this sort of conventional way of doing things? He said, you know, you guys, that's fine to do this, but you realize that there's all this actual on-field issues that you don't have any idea about. A pitcher has to warm up. And once you've warmed them up and you don't bring them in, you might not be able to use them again. And we were sitting here listening to this and going, oh. And I remember feeling really schooled by an actual baseball professional.
That was like a real egghead moment.
Right,
you know,
and we're like, boy, I think we have a lot to say, but we can't implement without actual on-field expertise.
Okay, and that's just a general lesson that we should be not just knowing ourselves, but preaching to other statisticians and data scientists.
That's right. It's a humility that Rick was saying, get over yourselves on this because you don't have the full story.
You're talking about Rick Peterson and giving some background that was eye-opening to you. Reminds me, out of the blue, of what Chris Collinsworth told us when we talked to him about Bill Belichick. He said he was at some practice, the Patriots practice, early in the season, and he came away thinking that Belichick was actually burning some wins early in the season in order to rotate defensive strategies and to train his players to play multiple strategies at a way that might cost them early season in order to learn and be better later in the season. And it did.
I do remember that now that you say it.
One of those really eye-opening
I have another one too, and it's a surprising one for me. It's one of our horse racing interviews.
It was the one where we were talking about like, you know, what really makes a horse like a true winner. It's the horse with the biggest heart. And we were all like, all of us cynically were like, oh, you know, we've heard that kind of
sports. The horse wants it the most.
But he was literally talking about biologically, the horse with the largest heart is the one most likely to win the race. And I thought that was just kind of a fun little.
That's
like
a top moment. Three. That's a consensus yeah. top also, three all time.
Also, in that same interview, he mentioned that also every horse slows down during the race, just who slows down the least.
Yeah. It's kind of like the sinking fastball
exactly.
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Which also was a great moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites was, I think, the first time we ever had Brian Burke on the show. So Brian is an ESPN analyst and one of the guys who's been on the cutting edge of football analytics for a while. Brian had been an engineer by training. He flew for the military. Mm-hmm. And then he got into football analytics. But his background had him very black and white. And when he got into football analytics, he started seeing shades of gray. He literally said, I had to start thinking probabilistically for the first time in my life. And he was saying, that's what stats and thinking about sports analytics did for me.
The thing that we also, I'm surprised it didn't come up as one of our themes also is the role of uncertainty, which is even if you put a probability on something, that's your point estimate of the probability. Like, in general, the classic rule of thumb is, well, in fact, I think what I'm about to say is probably a theorem, but Adi will correct me, which is, by definition, you're always underestimating the probability. Like, in other words, you could say, well, a fair coin's 50-50. Maybe. I don't know that. Like, maybe the way you flip it, I'm just saying you can always say there's some omitted factor that you're not putting in there. But I think, just to me, the role of uncertainty, even in things that are uncertain, we don't take into account enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have to evaluate that, and we've learned to do that over the years remarkably. But sometimes you have to do it fast. But in particular, you're talking about Brill Weiner, right? So we came to this idea saying, looking to figure out what is the uncertainty in the models, and what we really discovered.
And the models you're talking about are the fourth down
decisions.
The fourth
down models. What we really discovered is the data isn't really that rich. Which means that given data is a constraint, and as a result, you can come up with an estimate. But if you had gotten a different set of data, different 2,000 games, you might ask, well, how might the estimate change? And that's really what's called the confidence interval. We realize that those things were really wide, almost shockingly wide.
Because there's not much data in football.
Because there's just not that much data in football, which led us to which connected with the Rick Peterson comment, which says, wait a minute, if we don't really know, we have to have some humility about what we don't know.
Okay, this connects to two other of my favorite moments on the show. One is, it connects back to our regress your forecast. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite standout moments in memory was the last bit of the show, the last show before the 2016 presidential election. So we'd done a fair bit of analytics on the presidential election leading up to that. And if y'all remember, 538 famously had Hillary Clinton as, I don't know, 80% or something likely to win that election. And the last thing that happened on that show was Adi saying, I'm going to go with something. I'm be like, really? Like, how much less? I don't, 67?
I play that clip to my class every election
year. Do you
yes,
really?
I do. Right. I put it on there because it's so 538 was 80%, but almost every other forecast was like 99%.
Yeah, they were actually the most humble.
And Nate Silver just said, I just don't feel like it. And he did something completely unprobabilistic. He said, I know the data says it's a slam dunk for Hillary Clinton, but something doesn't feel right. And we had a conversation about what doesn't feel right on the show. And I was trying to argue that it's got to be a lot lower. Her probability of winning is a lot lower. And although I had no hard data to go on, I was just looking at previous elections within that calendar cycle in other countries where the populist candidate was coming up big and it had and overturning the forecast. That was a great moment.
So what I like about it is that's probably, that's 2016, so we're only 2 years into the show. Mm-hmm. We're talking about we're all cultivating this tendency to regress and pay attention to base rates. And the question was always like, are we? Like, do you? Yeah. Is that true? Because in that moment, I wasn't. Yeah. There's no way I was thinking, regress that forecast. It was only when Adi said, I'm going to regress that forecast. And now, because of that moment and because of the reinforcement that came about from the result, it does start maybe bringing us to that habit. But it's so easy to say it intellectually. But in the moment, we don't tend to do it. You did it in that moment.
And that was one of my kind of what I talked about, inevitability bias, or rounding those 80% up to one.
Exactly.
That was a moment. That was a real lesson for me. You know, that was kind of a real learning moment.
I want to name one other that's connected to this, and that is and it may be another question we can pursue in a second. It's like we've read some books every now and then for some of the people we interview, and we read a book called Escape from Model Land by Erica Thompson. And this is written by a modeler cautioning modelers to not get too caught up in your model. Like, you got to recognize what we all love our models, and we begin to think the world is our model, but the model is only an imperfect capture of the world. And we have to get out of that. And it connects exactly what Adi's saying about what's your data? You know, how sure are you of these estimates? You got to have that humility. It really comes back to that humility.
Well, you may also remember for years, I asked our guests the following question. I always used to end when I got my time to speak, I'd always ask the following question. You could have one of three things better. You could have better data, better model, or better, let's call it internal buy-in. I never, in all our years doing it, I never heard someone say a better model. Like, wow, you're right. My random forest, my XG boost model is just not working enough. I need a better model.
Need a deep neural net.
What
right?
you always hear is either it would be greater to have more impact at my company because there's a better connection, or I'd rather have a randomized experiment, or, you know, I have sparse data on fourth and one. I'd really rather have an infinite. Never did someone say a more sophisticated model that can give me another third significant digit on something,
Eric, that's,
ever.
That's you. I've heard you ask that question in lots of environments, on the show and off. I've stolen it on occasion myself. I didn't know that you'd done it enough to begin drawing inference about it, and I love that conclusion.
No one ever said the model, ever. Matter of fact, amazing. I'm pretty sure the number could be zero.
But it's interesting because if you talk to all the representatives of startup companies that are selling data and selling pipelines, like we just talked to people from Databricks, and we have talked to another company just recently called Shot Quality, they aren't selling models. Nobody's selling models. They just and I always wonder why they're not, because there's an edge there, right? They're selling serious strategy, advice, and data, and they just layer on top of it somebody's random forest or deep neural net, just something.
We're going to step away from this 10th anniversary conversation. Come back and join us after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
We are back with the rest of our 10th anniversary conversation here at Wharton Moneyball. To kick us off in this half of the show, we're going to talk about the COVID chapter of the Wharton Moneyball experience before we wrap up with some favorite moments about our time together. We're sitting here 10 years into Wharton Moneyball. All the co-hosts, longtime collaborators here, taking a moment to think about how the world has changed over those 10 years, how we've changed, some of the things we've learned, maybe some of the highlights. We were just talking about Erica Thompson's Escape from Model Land, which came out. She was studying partly COVID and talking about models in COVID. There was this moment in time, guys, where we were we were pretty much full-time COVID analysts. So March 2020 hit, and we started talking about COVID, making sense of COVID. At some point, we decided we're going to stay on this, and we're going to dedicate the first half hour, I think, of every week to COVID. What are your reflections now? That's been, we've shifted back more than 2 years ago now, but it was a long stretch. When you think back on it now,
3 months was an hour. We didn't have any sports. Remember that
the initial beginning. That's right. The first 3 months, it was all pandemic all the time. What reflections do you have on that stretch of Wharton?
I remember it extremely well because I really dived into the data deeply.
You became our expert.
The lesson that Model Land, the book, which came out much later, we learned on the fly because there were modelers coming out with forecasts for the spread of COVID and forecasts on diseases and on hospitalizations and everything that we wanted. And policy was being built on it. And those forecasts were terrible. And it was the best minds doing the best job with the data they had, and you couldn't do anything.
Couldn't do it.
And it was just an incredible, humbling lesson. Where I was disappointed was that people would put out models with their prediction intervals. And their prediction intervals, nobody's overlapped. And that said to me, this is a problem. If we have 10 different forecasts about where we're supposed to be going down the line, really time series forecasts with confidence bands or prediction bands on top of them, and they were all so depressingly narrow. And we looked at them and this is just bad. So not only were the forecasts bad, but much more importantly, the uncertainty was horribly underestimated. And that just kept appearing over and over again. As we moved through the pandemic, it was almost ridiculously tragic how little we could say with any accuracy.
I was just going to say, the one thing I remember, though, is that some things were relatively stable. Like, what I do remember is, because I remember each week, I was the one that was looking at the CDC data. and just seeing, like, in some sense, like the death rate conditional on your getting COVID was actually fairly constant for a long period of time. Now, of course, the question is, how many people are going to get COVID? Which people are going to get COVID? What's the risk for a certain population? But there was a period where I think the number was somewhere around, I have a vague recollection, maybe it was 1% or 0.8 of 1%, where if you looked at every country and you said, how many people have reported?
Reported, which actual, is hugely important.
I understand. Yeah. Reported, and how many people were dying? That number had a very narrow band and interval for a fairly long period of time.
So one thing that was interesting, because we talk about moments, when David Spiegelhalter came in as a guest later.
I was not there that day.
Which was amazing. He was one of the sharpest minds on COVID earliest on. He had a beautiful infection fatality curve that was by age that turned out to be just about exactly right. And he published that in like March of 2020. And we publicized it on our show and we talked about it. And many people came up to us that we provided solid, good data on COVID that they weren't getting anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what I'd like to hear a little bit more from you is like setting aside the vagaries of modeling the pandemic. Mm-hmm. What do we do well? What do we not do well in that show? I mean, did we stay too long? Did we spend too much time, too little time? Like, how did we? Because that was an incredible moment of uncertainty. And I think one of the things we did was we worked together to reduce that uncertainty. We were trying to make sense of it, like together. That's, I think, one of the virtues of what we did. What are your thoughts on the process?
And it gave us a vantage point, at least for me. I mean, it was obviously, I think, probably a frustrating time for all of us, but it was particularly frustrating for me, kind of along kind of, you know, Eric's way of kind of thinking about things. Would you rather have good data, good models, or buy-in? Right. That was a time in society where, although we, you know, could talk and we were mostly focused on evaluating the models, what we really needed was better data, and what we really needed was actual buy-in, you know, on public policy kind of initiatives. Yep. And so it was kind of, I mean, a little bit of therapy for me, but also like, you know, actual like instructive to kind of come in and hear mostly from Adi, like kind of the what was really kind of going on in the kind of modeling sphere, and also to kind of just be able to kind of, I don't know, express both of my kind of frustration, but also interest in what was kind of going on at a societal level at the time through kind of the lens of analytics and through the lens of trying to kind of think about what we could actually measure, you know, without bias, et cetera.
I have to admit, though, I also, when I think back to that period, I also have to think about how I remember thinking to myself how, you know, we're exactly the same age. And so I remember there were times where you would say, yeah, you know what? I would go out and have some sort of party with friends. And I remember I would say it on the air like, oh, I would never have done that.
No.
That was fascinating to me.
It was.
And by the way, I don't think of myself as overly risk averse in any particular way. And you were our expert. So most of the information I was getting from you, just my interpretation of it was, like, I'm not going to go for that really, even if it's a low probability event, it's just not worth it. And that to me, I will remember all the decisions you guys made. And like I was proud, like, wow, I got my like 80th shot. And Adi's like, I don't know if you should be getting that many shots. And I'm like, I've got 80.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, kind of really, it was a lesson how that distribution of like kind of risk tolerance versus risk adversity, how much variation there is across people within a person even over time.
Yeah, that was
in that kind of, in that.
It was fascinating. But one of the things we learned about COVID during that time, which has been really useful, is the importance of observational data is distinct from experimental data. And in sports, we talk about confounding. It's just the most important concept in all any evaluation of a complex game where everybody interacts with each other, particularly basketball, soccer, football, much less so baseball, but even that to a degree. And what this forced us to constantly ask when we looked at a study, well, these aren't experiments. And so much public policy and so much discussion around COVID was built around observational data, some of it terribly done, some of it better done. And we were able to explain that to our listeners, to each other, and make sense out of it. And this was really one of the most, and I think it really carried us through. It puts front and center the scientific method, which is at heart really what statistics is serving, the acquisition of knowledge and truth.
Okay, so everything you said I have to agree with entirely, of course, but it also feels like one of the things that happened in the pandemic is that experimental evidence by itself was too isolated to really explain what happens in the complicated world. It goes the other direction as well.
We didn't have experiments, if that's what you mean.
Well, you can't experiment with you have a hard time experimenting with societal uptake mm-hmm. of policies. And the biggest confounder, especially early on, was people didn't act the way they were supposed to act in the models. And we wouldn't have known that, I don't think, from an experiment. So in this case, I think it goes, the difficulty is you need to go both ways.
We had to explain this, that why these weren't predictable. What was the issues? And we did, I think that was one of our strongest points.
Within the field of statistics, as you know, nobody would consider me an expert specifically in causal inference. Mm-hmm. That's not really the domain I operate right. in. But I kind of felt like, you know, when I was having with my friends and kind of with the lay people I was talking to, like having to explain just kind of very basic what you can learn from an experiment, what you can not learn from, you know,
observational study is. Controlled observational study. Yeah.
All right, guys, let's shift out of the pandemic and do a lightning round before we end up with a couple of final questions. Lightning round, back to favorite moments, but let's look at some specific narrow aspects of the show. Any favorite guest moments or interviews? Any things jump out to you over the years? We've talked about some so far. I mean, you've had some big baseball guys. Did you just love having by any chance?
We had Ron Bloomberg, which I enjoyed immensely.
I don't know if Matt was the producer then, but Sam Gwynn wrote a book about Hal Mumme, the famous football coach who was kind of the beginning of the air raid. And Sam Gwynn, and so we had him on the show. I didn't know he was going to be on the show. I had just read an earlier book of his that is really about the history of Texas that was profound for me. And I come in some Wednesday morning and Matt's lined up Sam Gwynn for the interview segment. Like, oh my God, this guy just wrote this amazing book. Just random, mm-hmm. you know, pleasure. Any other guests jump out?
Well, when we were on Radio Row for one of the Super Bowl, I think the Super Bowl in Miami, and we got to interview Justin Tuck on the show, and I was wearing the same Tom Brady coat, and just the absolute look of disgust on his face was kind of a great moment. That was a great interview, too, because, again, Justin Tuck, you know, he's not, I don't think, the most, you know, necessarily analytically minded like athlete, but it was a really informative kind of discussion because we talked a lot about, you know, I mean, he was, you know, on the defense that went up against some great teams in the Super Bowl, and just sort of the way he thought about, you know, battling Brady and the way he thought about other quarterbacks. I just remember it being a really cool discussion.
I loved also the moments we've talked about. We could call them the more secondary sports, like when we've had people on golf talk about the golf analytics and, you know, like the smarter players know where to forget. They know they're going to be inaccurate. So they choose a zone that they're not going to cause themselves as much damage. Like you could go for the left side of the green, but you know you should shoot for the right side of the green because here's how much variance there is in your shot. That's something that really has always stuck with me.
That was one of my most eye-opening interviews. I'd forgotten about that. That was one of those moments where I'm listening to this guy talk, and it's Scott Fawcett. Golf coach. He played some golf coach now in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And we chase him down because of an article in the newspaper, and he starts talking on our show about these guys have to act like they're going to hit it perfectly because you got to have confidence, but they have to plan knowing that they can't hit it perfectly. Right. Even the best golfers in the world. He was talking about accepting uncertainty and accommodating uncertainty in your decision-making. It was absolutely profound moment. Loved it.
Yeah. So I have a few, but I remember some of my favorites were David Epstein. He's written two of my favorite books on sports. One is The Sports Gene, and I interviewed him about that book. I may have been alone. This was a long time ago. And then he had a second book, Range, which he talked to us about the importance of athletes trying out different sports and how that's important for success. That was just, those were incredible interviews. And then, of course, I remember Annie Duke's first interview with us. She came live in the studio. She was writing a book, Thinking in Bets, and she talked about poker and reading opponents. And I remember one thing she said to us, she's been on many times. She comes to my Moneyball Academy every summer. But she talked about how the importance of exactly the opposite of what we do, which is, you know, calmly think about data and regress. But when you're in a poker tournament, you got to size up that opponent immediately. You don't have time to wait and watch their play and accumulate data and move yourself off the prior. You've got to look at everything they do, how they touch their chips, how they talk to each other to quickly figure out what type of player. Because if you get it wrong, you're going to get hammered. And it's like very observable, just the expertise that goes into being a professional poker player that's much more beyond just the strategy of just doing
that. I remember that, too. It was super insightful. And I kind of found myself coming back to that because, you know, it was really about what she's talking about is like very subtle body language that as kind of a professional in the field, you learn, you know, you really immerse yourself in. When coming out of COVID, one thing, or going through COVID and coming out of it, I kind of, for my own teaching, I realized just how much I feed off the body. Like you are subtly measuring the body language of people. Like teaching in front of people in person is a very different kind of endeavor because you can read the body language of people and very subtle.
I
could perceive what I was picking up on in very sort of subtle signs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably, you know, for poker players to kind of become that as their vocation, that it almost becomes probably second nature in a way I didn't even realize I was doing it as a teacher.
A favorite offsite moment.
Well, I can start with one. You mentioned Justin Tuck before, but on our offsite moment, I was quoting, I think, Rufus Peabody or Cade Massey talking about how you predict future football games and how no player can change the line when they go down except for a quarterback. Otherwise, it just doesn't affect it. And we're not saying those players aren't important. We can't measure it. And I told this to Justin Tuck, and he looked at me, and this very imposing human being looked like he was ready to take me down. Like, what are you saying? I don't matter, and here I am trying to scramble. Wait a minute. But of course, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. One of mine was at the Miami Super Bowl. We ended up at a bar on South Beach late after dinner, and Eric Eager was there with somebody of his from the Kansas City area.
Yeah.
But this was January or early February 2020, which means pandemic was already in the air. But Eric had been using some diffusion model based on pandemics in one of his sports papers. And so he was studying pandemic models in the months prior to this. And he sits there late at night drinking some monster margarita or whatever it was on South Beach. And he said, I think y'all should be looking at this pandemic thing.
But you know what I took out of that lesson, that conversation? I think we should be talking to Eric Eager.
That's right.
He's not only been on our guest many times, but he's now a longtime collaborator with us at Moneyball Academy. So that was an incredible offsite moment.
That's right.
Honestly, I was thinking of that I think that same evening talking with Eric Eager, because I was thinking about that kind of in the context, because that was 2020, right before the pandemic hit. That was right before, you know, the Chiefs were about to play the 49ers. I think that was the Super Bowl. And he was already talking about a Chiefs dynasty, and I'm like, this guy's getting a little ahead of himself. What does he know? This guy's a blowhard, and you know,
turns out. Do you remember when they had the NFL draft here in Philadelphia?
I do.
And we went and did the show on site beforehand, but then we started walking around backstage. And we end up walking through the dadgum green room. Players sitting around with their families. We're like, yeah, we're not supposed to be in here.
Well, it's funny because some of my favorite offsite moments was going down to spring training, bringing our equipment.
Talk about being somewhere you're not supposed to be.
Right. And I get myself press access and I wander into the Yankee dugout and the Yankee clubhouse. And I'm walking around with all the real reporters. I'm going, what do I do with myself? So I go find CC Sabathia. And I'm like, no one's talking to him. Which they were. And I talked to him, and I'm trying to explain the opener to CC Sabathia.
You tell us, remind us what the opener is.
So the opener is an idea that I've talked about on the show for years, is that the baseball team can get an advantage by beginning the game with one of their very good relief pitchers.
Since it's been for the adopted, first inning. Maybe and in through fact, your influence, it, perhaps.
Yeah, so in fact, Ty Bloom, when he was teams. At Toronto, Tampa Bay Rays, I talked to him. They were the first team to really do it. But I was trying to evangelize on it, and I said to CeCe, you know, you should be in favor of the opener. And he's like, no, we're starters. We're trained to start the game. And he's an imposing human being. And it's just a ridiculous idea that I would start the game in anything other than the first inning. And I said, well, you know, it has some advantage. And I start to explain them. And one of the things I said was, you'll have the opportunity to get the win without having to pitch five innings. And without even missing a beat, he says, I thought you stat heads don't value wins.
Well, that is awesome.
He just nice. Handed me one.
There's so much in that story. Guys. Absolutely incredible. Okay, last lightning round question. Eric, you mentioned the less popular sports like golf, but what about non-sports? Other than the pandemic, we do sometimes wander off the playing fields into other areas. Any favorite non-sport moments? And to give you all a moment to think about it, I'll tell you my favorite It's the Moneyball for Fire
guys. Yeah, the Forest Fire guys is what I was thinking of.
We just
I know you love them.
Well, yeah. We hypothesized that they must... This was the summer of, I think it might have been 2020, and bad forest fires in the American Northwest. And we thought someone is running analytics on that. And we asked Matt to run it down. And he's like, sure enough, I found these guys who were publishing papers, one of which is called Moneyball for Fire. And now we have a multi-year relationship with these guys. We've had on the show multiple times. And they fight the same battles, the exact same culture battles that we see fought in football organizations, basketball organizations, baseball organizations. It's incredible.
So yeah, I mean, talk about a cool spatial temporal data situation that basically pops up every year. Links to so much of the kind of climatic things that are going on right now as well.
One of my favorite non-sports topics was the traffic engineer we had on years ago, right before Thanksgiving. You may not remember
I don't think I was on this show.
You may not have been on it. I wasn't alone. I know there was a few of us there.
I think I remember that.
And he was talking about essentially Moneyball for designing highways. And one of his comments was that we in America don't do things properly. We just build wider roads when we want to accommodate more traffic. But that can be accomplished by learning how to drive.
Oh, really?
We just don't drive properly.
Huh.
And he explained the various ways. In principle, he was saying, stay out of the left lane unless you're passing, and how much trouble that causes. And he explained how the models show how your roads become inefficient when people drive improperly. And he was, of course, saying, but in Germany, where he was a German engineer, we don't build wide roads. We teach people to drive properly.
Speaking of Germans, we have the diet researcher out of Duke, whose name I'm going to forget, but he's given us some great stuff over the years on calories, like really good stuff. All right, we need to wrap up, and so I want to ask one last question. We've been talking about the last 10 years, of course, and appropriately. Hopefully we'll do another 10 years and more in front of us. What is one hope you have or ambition you have for the show over the next 10 years?
I think it's going to be really cool 5, 6, 7 years from now when we all have Hall of Fame votes and we can on the air. We argue about the Hall of Fame for weeks every year. Won't it be great as voting members to do that?
I'd like us to do an offsite at the Hall of Fame. I mean, I'm saying that baseball Hall of Fame, but as a matter of fact, we could do all of them. I mean, actually, you can actually do the baseball, basketball, football Hall of Fame in one swing. I mean, it's not that far from each other, the major sports. I don't even know. Where's the Hockey Hall of Fame?
Toronto.
All right. Well, it's not totally out of the question.
It sounds like a really fun
trip. But either way,
I
have such a passion for the history of baseball especially and the Baseball Hall of Fame that I think it would be great to do a show from there. And I'm confident that we could get a number of Hall of Famers to come on the air. And I'm sure they would talk to us about the role that analytics played in their careers. And it would be great to get a spectrum, you know, getting someone whose major career was in the 70s and 80s in the pre-analytics era, then get someone in the 90s and 2000s when it was emerging, and then get even the most recent Hall of Famers. That would be a ton of fun.
Yeah, I mean, sorry to just piggyback on that. Like, I as I was sort of thinking about the last 10 years, I feel like we do kind of, you know, because we've been doing this a while, I think we have a historical perspective on things. I would like us to do even more of a kind of like, you know, this year, like, you know, 10 years ago, what was going on, both in like sports itself and also in analytics. You know, I think so many people, you know, the field has moved so quickly in, say, the last 20 years that, you know, kind of like, you know, we're the last keepers of the generation without internet or whatever. We have an obligation to remind people what it was like and where we
Well, Shane, what we may find out in the next 10 years is, you know, Adi was talking about, you know, running more sophisticated models. Maybe artificial intelligence and these large language models are going to change the way we do even sports analytics. Like, maybe we're going to be able to just upload a massive amount of video and other stuff and just say, you know, run, you know, compress this using a variation encoder and just run some analysis on this and it'll get automatically done. I have a feeling that 10 years from now, the use of video data and other types of data will be much more prevalent in sports because of all these technology and AI that's going on.
I think that's a fascinating prediction. I have to second Eric's Hall of Fame show. I mean, we're a kind of a force in this department. It's my obsession, and just because of loving baseball and baseball history in particular. So I'm just seconding that one. But if I had to say I'd like to see something in the next 10 years, I'd like us to reflect a little bit about what's happened on the sports analytics side, kind of on the research end, and kind of reflect on our particular area, which is the academic contribution of sports analytics and methods, and just reflect on some of the great papers, the great contributors, interview some of the scientists involved. We haven't done too much of that. We do the new stuff. We're very good with new, but we haven't had the opportunity, maybe it's my bias, of reflecting historically about what's happened and kind of not a time-based moment, but talk to some of the people who are really involved in pushing our subject forward.
That's eminently doable, right? That's great.
Yeah.
The road trip I'll pitch for is a combine. So the combine week right now in Indianapolis.
The baseball, it wouldn't save me any time because I watch the whole thing anyway.
You have to bring your second and third and fourth screens for other sports.
That's true.
You got to pick up on that subtle body language of being in person that we've discussed already, though.
Right.
You don't get
that
across the TV.
There's a baseball combine now that could be interesting. Yeah. But I do think it'd be, we saw this technology evolve over the last 10 years, and we were having conversations with people when it first came out. I'm curious, can we remain on that cutting edge? And what does it take for us to remain on that cutting edge? So you just mentioned AI, and you talked about, dumping a bunch of video data. But it may be even earlier that what AI does, it levels the coding playing field.
Yep.
And other people can get into analytics without having to go through years, basically, of coding training. Could be. That could be one of the big things. Are we going to be doing the interviews and the research and the reading to really know what happens next? We did it the last 10 years. We need to keep on. Whatever that was that kept us at the front edge, we need to keep on doing.
Or all the companies like Pro Football Focus that do a lot of human coding. Well, once we have a lot of human coded data, we have supervised learning we can do. So now we're going to use human coders, but we're going to use them to train our models. And then we're just going to let our models rip on all the data we can collect in some large automated way. As a matter of fact, over the years, we've had a lot of people talk about the different value of having cameras and locations and other stuff in stadiums. I think the volume of especially video data, we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with that in a large automated way.
All right. That was our conversation. That was our pause in the Wharton Moneyball experience to think about the last 10 years. Appreciate you guys being here for it. Appreciate your listening to us all these years. Appreciate the guests and the comments and the ideas you've given us. We are better because of it. We are thankful for the last 10 years, and we very much look forward to many more to come.